Episode 299 of the Pilot the Pilot podcast takes off now. Fly with Garmin Avionics, then grab your mobile device and make the Garmin Pilot app your cockpit companion. Get advanced functions you'll use before, during, and after every flight, including updating your aircraft's databases and logging engine data. Plan, file, fly, log with Garmin Pilot.
The Pilot to Pilot podcast is brought to you by Learn the Finer Points. Use the link below to save 10% off their ground school app.
Aviation, there's a new offer from SiriusXM. Make sure you upgrade your next flight without upgrading your plane by getting the Garmin GDL52 portable receiver. The GDL52 has ADS-B traffic and weather plus SiriusXM weather and entertainment. It has Bluetooth and works with Garmin Pilot apps. For a limited time, you can get a $300 rebate on the GDL52, plus it comes with a free 3-month trial of SiriusXM's weather and entertainment. I love flying with SiriusXM, and it's honestly one of my favorite features about having the G5000, so the GDL52 will offer you a very similar outlook on the weather and also getting to listen to some awesome radio stations on SiriusXM. So check out the GDL52 at aopa.org/SiriusXM.
Hey, my name is Seth Lake. I'm a designated pilot examiner. I'm an Air Force reservist, and I work for a major airline as first officer.
Aviation, what is going on, and welcome back to the Pilot to Pilot podcast. My name is Justin Seams, and I am your host. Today's episode is with Seth from VSL Aviation. Seth is a DPE. He's an airline pilot and a former military pilot, also a CFI and a former flight school owner. So Seth has done a lot in aviation, and this is a jam-packed episode. You're going to get tips from how to do well on your private pilot check ride to how to get into the military aviation and what the best route Seth believes is, and also how to choose an airline. So I really am thankful for Seth coming on, and I really hope you do enjoy this episode. If you do enjoy this episode, make sure to check out Bold Aviator, the Pilot to Pilot collab hats. They are legit. If you want some Pilot to Pilot Bold Aviator collab shirts, let me know. We might be making some. So if you're interested in that, let me know. But Aviation, I don't want to keep any longer. Without any further ado, here's Seth from VSL Aviation.
Seth, what's going on, man? Welcome to the Pilot to Pilot podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me, Justin.
No problem. Excited to have you on. Like we kind of talked about before, hit record. It's been a disaster getting this scheduled, which I feel like I've been telling everyone I've recorded with in the last month. So I appreciate it. But it'll be fun. Be a fun couple hours. It'll be a fun hour. And we'll talk about some aviation, have some fun. Sound good?
Yeah, sounds great.
Cool, man. Well, first thing I gotta say is you are probably one of the youngest DPEs that I've seen. Maybe you're older than you look, but you look relatively young. How did? Well, I mean, we'll get into this later, but how do you become a DPE at so young? Such a young age.
Yeah, I get that a lot, actually, and I'm kind of aware of that too. There's a lot of, you know, we'll call them more mature examiners that are out there. The way I got involved with the DPE gig is I was volunteering in my capacity as an Air Force officer. I was a safety officer, and I was helping do some safety seminars for the Air Force program called the Mid-Air Collision Avoidance Program, or MACA. And, you know, we'd go out and talk to civilian pilots about our low-level operations and how to avoid mid-air collisions. And that got me involved in the FAA safety team, and I was also an evaluator pilot there in the C-130. So when a position became available at the FISDO to become a DPE, they suggested that I put in an application, and I met all the qualifications, and, you know, there I was. And I think I became a DPE around 37. So there was a lot of other DPEs that were, I think the next oldest was, you know, probably in their 50s. But we've been hiring some younger examiners, which I think is a good thing, you know, so I'm definitely not the youngest anymore.
I flew with a buddy, and he started his own flight school, and he was very, very adamant that there is a huge DPE shortage. Like, you heard about the pilot shortage, but the DPE shortage is even worse. It's like, I can barely get people to do check rides. It's a mess.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of different reasons for that. I'm on Reddit a little bit. I made a post on Reddit a few months ago that kind of my thoughts on why there's a shortage. But yeah, there's a shortage. I don't know if there's a long-term shortage. I think there's just a surge of pilots that we're making right now. And so the old system just isn't very flexible. So it's been hard for the FAA to flex to meet all the demand for the new check rides that we've been having for the increase in flight training activity, I think.
Yeah, which is good because we need the pilots, so bring them on over, right?
yeah, build that seniority.
Yeah, build that seniority even as a DP, right?
Yeah.
Well, let's go way back, you know, not to where you are as a DP at 37 when you got it, but let's go back to young Seth. Why did you even want to be a pilot in the first place?
I mean, you probably hear this a lot, but I don't remember a time I didn't want to be a pilot. So I'm not really sure what happened when I was a child to make me want to fly so much. It's not a family thing. My dad was in the military and, always wanted to be in the military too. So that was a big goal of mine in high school, was to get into either the Air Force Academy or a ROTC program, become an officer. So I was in, you know, Civil Air Patrol as a teenager and learned how to fly there, and then was able to get a ROTC scholarship, went to the University of Arkansas, became a Air Force pilot there. So I sort of started out GA, but I didn't fly a lot of GA other than the limited stuff I did in the Civil Air Patrol. So mainly started flying in the Air Force, but that was a goal. You know, I was born right around time Top Gun came out, so I can't say that, you know, watching that movie 100 times when I was a kid didn't have some effect. But even before then, I just love airplanes.
Yeah, man, it is amazing the influence that Top Gun had on aviation as a whole. Just hearing pretty much, I'd probably put it up 50-50. If someone's in the military and they're flying airplanes, it's because of Top Gun.
Yeah. And if there's somebody who's my age that says Top Gun didn't have an effect, then they're lying to you. You know, I'm just being honest here. So
what was it about Top Gun? Was it the riding a motorcycle, just Tom Cruise in general? Everyone wanted to be him.
It was just a great movie. You know, it was, I don't know what it is. Never had a motorcycle, you know, didn't take it that far. I do have a sweet bomber jacket that I rock in the uniform, but yeah, that first time in the T6, you're like putting the helmet on and the visor and the mask, and you're like, oh wow, this is crazy. Turns out, you know, military pilot lifestyle maybe isn't as glamorous as the movies make it out to be, but I don't regret anything about my Air Force career. I love it.
Yeah, that's amazing. Probably a lot of bars, though. They probably got that scene, that kind of part of the context of being a military pilot, right?
Yeah. Not a lot of group random singing, breaking out in the bars. Yeah, not a lot of that in my experience.
Right. When you were, let's talk a little about Civil Air Patrol. We hear about it. You see it. You know, like certain airports have it. Maybe your airport has it, but I feel like not enough people really know about the mission or know what it's like to actually be a part of that organization. Can you talk a little about Civil Air Patrol and how
it
helped you become a pilot?
So I got, you know, I was just a cadet member. I haven't volunteered as a senior member yet. I might in the future when I get a little bit more time on my hands, but, yeah, as a cadet, I was never in the scouts or anything, but I think it's similar to that. You know, it's kind of two parts. One is it's core mission is search and rescue. Now, as a cadet, you're not doing a ton of search and rescue, but you do go out and help during exercises. And we had like aircraft, you'd fly as a spotter and, you know, help operate the radios. That was an option. That was one component of it. I think the larger component of it is it's more of an aerospace education format. So they had a whole aerospace education course that you'd take. It's similar to like a in-person ground school, and that's taught by senior members who are pilots. So I thought that was really valuable. And the other part is a little bit of a military discipline. So you actually learn how to march and wear a uniform, which wound up being, you know, pretty helpful, I think, because when I got into ROTC and the Air Force, that was a little bit less stress because I already knew how to wear the uniform. I knew how to march, or at least I had been exposed to that. So it wasn't quite as much of a shock when I got into the military. We also had to do, I think, like even PT tests, which is something that is part of life in the military too. So it was actually a good kind of preparation for entering the Air Force. And the aerospace education was a huge bonus. And the biggest bonus for me was you could rent the Civil Air Patrol aircraft for just the cost of fuel. So I don't know if that's still the case. And the senior members would volunteer. If you had a senior member on staff who was an instructor, they would give you flight instruction for free. So you got free flight instruction, and the plane you get just for gas. So it was an incredibly cheap way to get my pilot's license.
So now you as a DPE, a CFI, are you going to give back and be like, hey, free check rides, free this, free that?
Yeah, I try to give back as much as I can. You know, I produce a lot of free content to try to help people prepare for their check rides. So that's kind of one of the ways that I give back. Yeah, I give a few free check rides. I've done scholarship programs before. And then, yeah, I plan on working with the Civil Air Patrol as a senior member in the future. Probably waiting for the reserve career to retire. I'll retire from the reserves here in a few years. And once I get that off my plate, I'll probably start volunteering for the Civil Air Patrol then.
There you go. Last thing about Civil Air Patrol, is it, I know it's like military style, where there's military incorporated into there. Like you said, like PT test, marching, wearing a uniform. How about the overall attitude of the whole place? Is it a lot of the same like respect? I mean, obviously you're going to respect who you're with, but is it very similar kind of structure to how you would expect to act or be kind of instructed in a military setting at the Civil Air Patrol?
Yeah, I'd say to some extent, it's probably dependent on each squadron. So it's obviously more casual, I think, than active duty military. And we had very few senior members that were retired military. I think we maybe had one or two. So I can imagine a squadron that had a lot of retired military guys, it might be a little more formal. And then somebody that just has a lot of general aviation pilots that with no military experience would be a little less formal. But yeah, it wasn't, you know, it's not the you know, what you might see in the movies of like military bearing and standing at attention and doing that. That's very little of that. Now, the one exception is they have summer programs. I did an undergraduate pilot training kind of experience course. I forget the name of that, but I actually went to Columbus Air Force Base for about a week and a half when I was probably 16. And we sat in with a UPT class for a full week, and they were flying the T-37. We had to memorize emergency procedures and do stand up with them. And that was really cool because, I don't know, like, you know, 8 years later, I was in UPT myself, not at Columbus, but it was kind of cool because it's like, wow, I've already seen this. It's kind of behind the scenes. So you do get exposed to some like actual military environments if you do some of those summer programs.
Yeah. And so that didn't scare you away at all? That wasn't like, oh my gosh, wow, he's really getting chewed out. You're like, yes, I want to do that.
Yeah, it didn't scare me off. So, yeah. You know, that was
That's good. Awesome. Well, fast forward a little bit. So we, Civil Air Patrol played a huge part. Very thankful for it, I'm guessing. But when did you get your private instrument commercial? Did you wait until you went to Arkansas to get all that, or did you get that all done before?
So I actually just got I got all of my ratings with the Air Force, essentially. So my instrument, commercial, multi, all of that, I got equivalency ratings. So I did all of my UPT. So I did very little flying in between the end of high school and, the beginning of pilot training. I just focused on college. You know, for those looking to get in the military, ROTC is a great route. I did a 4-year degree at the University of Arkansas. I was just a regular civilian student. And then like once or twice a week, you got to wear the uniform. You do some kind of an OTS style or officer training school somewhere in the middle of your college experience there during the summer. And then you graduate and you commission as a second lieutenant. And so that's what I did. Basically within 6 months of finishing college, I was starting my pilot training out at Vance Air Force Base. So I flew the T-6, and then when I was going through, they actually had a King Air program in Corpus Christi. So I knew that I wanted to fly the C-130, always wanted to fly the C-130. I grew up in Arkansas, and we're kind of the home of the C-130. And the farm I live on is right underneath a low-level route of these of the Hercs. And so I grew up on this farm. I'd be out there on the tractor in the hayfield during the summer, and the four ship the C-130s fly over, and I just thought it was awesome. So. That's what I wanted to fly. What's the Air Force
Base just north of Little Rock?
Yeah, just north of Little Rock. It's called Little Rock Air Force Base. It's actually in Jacksonville. Yeah, if you've been into LIT, you know, it's about 20 miles
north. Oh, I've been to North Little Rock more than I wanted to be at the other airport. Really? When I did the aerial survey, we would go into there, and it's pretty close to the Air Force Base. And, you know, you land, and they'd be like, all right, you got to watch out for these whatever it is. And I was like, oh, wow, that's cool. You know, I had like 300 hours flying a 310 and don't get to see that very often. So it's kind of eye-opening experience about aviation and just proximity to Air Force bases.
Yeah. North Little Rock, I used to have a couple hangars out there. Cool. I kept some planes in. So I still have a lot of friends around there. But yeah, that's right there by the airbase.
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty funny. It's really funny hearing you talk about ROTC. Obviously, I mean, I went to Ohio State, so they have the ROTC program. One of my dorms was close to ROTC, so you'd see them all the time. And I always be like, dang, they're like, it always seemed like they're doing way more than I thought they were doing. But when you actually talk to ROTC people, it doesn't sound like it's too much of a commitment, right? Like, it's not crazy when you're in college. Obviously, there's more of a commitment than your standard student who is just kind of hanging out and doing whatever they want, whenever they want. But it doesn't sound like it's as bad as what I thought it was when I was in college.
Yeah, I don't think it is. I thought it was definitely manageable, and ROTC wants you to be successful in college. So, you can, it's probably like any other organization. I was never in a fraternity. I wasn't a college athlete like you were. So I would imagine being a college athlete is similar, where you can either, you can really invest a lot in your athletic career, or you can do as little as possible and focus more on your education, but you're obviously probably won't be as successful in your athletic career if you're focusing on school and vice versa. So,
and you probably get yelled at for both of them if you don't do well in school. So probably pretty similar.
Yeah. So ROTC, they want you to be successful in college, but you do have to, do some extra stuff. And then you can also, get more involved in ROTC. And the way they encourage that is you get stratified within your ROTC detachment. And that has an effect on what jobs you get, assigned coming out of ROTC. So I wanted to be a pilot, and that's typically a little bit more difficult. So, you really didn't want to minturn the, do as little as possible. You wanted to be as involved as you could be. And make sure your uniform's sharp, make sure you know all the, dress and appearance standards, and that's the easy stuff, being fit, taking care of your uniform, looking sharp, that's the easy stuff. So that takes time. You got to iron your uniform, you got to stay in shape, you got to work out in the morning. So, that's maybe the stuff that, you were seeing a lot of ROTC people do, kind of the extra there.
When you're, in ROTC and you say you want to be a pilot, I'm guessing you can't just be like, all right, I want to be a pilot, I'm going to do, communications degree. Like, you got to have a little bit of a, not bagging on anyone that has a communications degree, but usually I would imagine that they'd want to see you have some kind of engineering degree or I guess engineering per se, really. Did you get an engineering degree or did you get a communications degree? That'd be really funny if you did.
Yeah, I got a communication. No, I got a business degree. I was information system or information. Information systems.
So I guess you can choose essentially whatever you want to actually major in those still, right? Okay.
Cool. Yeah. In fact, back when I was going through, they sort of encouraged engineering degrees. However, if you got into an engineering degree and it's really difficult and you can't maintain a good GPA, you might be ranked a little bit lower than somebody that had, an easier degree, that had a higher GPA. So you unless you really enjoy engineering. Now, there's some jobs in the Air Force as a pilot that you need an engineering degree for. So if you wanted to go to test pilot school, obviously that's going to happen later in your career. But to be a test pilot school candidate, you're going to have an engineering degree. So, if that's something that you really wanted to do, you need that engineering degree. For me, I'm basically driving a big dump truck. They don't care what degree you have. So
I fly planes. Yeah.
They're fine with a business degree.
Yeah. It's funny that you just brought up the test pilots. I just interviewed two NASA test pilots yesterday, and they were talking about the whole process of becoming a test pilot and how you pretty much need to be an engineer. And I was like, well, all right, good thing I never tried to apply because I'm not an engineer and that would not work out well.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's
if you're going to be a test pilot, that's a pretty high level. I know a couple of test pilots that were C-130 pilots and they went on because, mobility aircraft or, cargo aircraft need test pilots too. So they went through the TPS school, and talking to them after going to that school, it's, It's probably not what people think. It'd be interesting to hear what your NASA guys say, but you know, it's a lot different, I think, than it was back in the 50s and 60s with Chuck Yeager, you know, ejecting every other day out of some aircraft. It's a lot more boring than that, probably.
Yep, that's the kind of the vibe I got. But it's probably still more exciting than I want to be in an airplane. I like nice, boring flights, you know, and nothing happening, no cast messages, no oral warnings. Like, just get me to point A to point B as smooth as possible, please.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. So talk a little about your training in the Air Force. You mentioned that you got most of your training done in the Air Force, but obviously you came with a little bit of background. Do you think that background information that you had with from Civil Air Patrol and flying airplanes, do you think that really helped you and kind of set you apart?
I don't know. I think it maybe helped on the margins a little bit. I think past the first month of pilot training, everybody was pretty much on the same level that had just had the level of training I had. Now we had two folks that had gone all the way through ATP. Now they obviously, I think, benefited a lot more when it came to like instrument flying. But if you're talking about just basic, private stuff, I don't know that helped a ton. But it, you know, I guess it helps on your air sense. You've been in the air before. I still got sick my first flight, the T6. So luckily, I only got sick on that flight, and then I was over it. But it might have helped a little bit, but I don't think it's hugely important. You come with a lot of training into pilot training.
That'd be bad to join the military to become a pilot. You get a T6, find out you throw up every flight and you can't do it anymore, so they just send you to a desk job.
Yeah, unfortunately, we had a couple in our class that really struggled with air sickness, and there's a whole air sickness program you'll get put in before you get it eliminated. So they do try to work with you to overcome the air sickness. So I think both of our, both guys in my class were able to overcome it. But
that's
it's
awesome.
Not fun.
No one wants to throw up in an airplane.
Yeah.
All right. So you're going through this process. You start in the T6. Was the C-130 the overall goal of what you wanted the whole time? Is that kind of like the creme de la crop for you? Or were you kind of open to some other things that went on?
Yeah, I think the C-130 was really what I wanted to do. And it came with added benefit. I got to skip out on the last part of pilot training with the Air Force and go train with the Navy down in Corpus Christi in the King Air to do all your multi-engine stuff in the King Air. So I got to go down to wonderful Corpus Christi for a few months and train with the Navy. Training with the Navy was awesome. I love Navy training. Air Force training was super stressful. I'll be honest, it was pretty stressful.
Navy is a little more laid back.
Yeah, the Navy is like, we called it a big boy program. So you were kind of in charge of your own training. So like, hey, you've got a flight next Tuesday. In the Air Force, you would be at work every single day until then. In the Navy, it's like, well, just show up an hour before brief and you're good to go.
Yeah. So the King Air, what's crazy about the King Air is I also was doing aerial survey in Victoria, Texas. So I'm guessing you spent enough time in Victoria, Texas, because all I saw there was King Air, Navy King Air trainers. And I guess there was a little restaurant that they would always go to not too far away from the FBO. So I'm not sure if you did that too.
Yeah, the fun thing about flying in Texas is like we would call them fat and backs. So we'd do a two ship, a formation of two King Airs. We'd take off, we'd fly low level somewhere to like random place in Texas. We'd land, we'd get like barbecue or whatever, get back in, do another low level, and then shoot a bunch of instrument approaches somewhere in the middle there. And we went all over Texas and Louisiana. I've been to Victoria. Chenault was a big one we'd go to a lot. College Station. I mean, you name it, we've probably been there. And if you've flown in South Texas a lot, you've probably seen those like orange and white King Airs fly around. That's what we're doing.
Did you go to Laredo at all?
I think so. I don't know that I ever stopped in there.
Yeah, when I flew freight, we lived in Laredo, essentially. So it's a big freight mecca for shady freight operators. Yeah, it's crazy. My buddy is in the Navy. Well, he's getting out of the Navy soon, probably going to reserves. But he, I was so jealous because he did his prior, essentially his private or whatever it is. Then he goes into his multi-engine training into a King Air with like 100 hours. And I was like, dude, I got 300 hours and I'm barely flying a 310. It's like, how are you in a King Air right now? It's like, this is just messed up.
Yeah.
So it's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, it is crazy because I think we started flying the, and they have the King Air 90 and the 200. I was in the 200 and I had like, you know, maybe 100 hours in the T6, and then they put you in the King Air, and then you only get about, I think, you know, 80 to 100 hours in the King Air. And the next plane I was flying was the C-130. So you go from T6, which is, pretty small, to the King Air, to a transport category plane in like, you know, a year and a half. And it's pretty wild.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit more about coming from your training, moving up. You did the King Air, like you said, you only had 100 hours. You're in a King Air. You're not in the King Air for very long before you move on. What comes next after the King Air?
Yeah. So you're basically in the King Air for, like I said, about, you know, 80 to 100 hours. And then you go to, first of all, you have to choose which C-130 you're going to fly. So it's a little different than the rest of the Air Force, where you get to choose what aircraft you're going to fly. The King Air pipeline for the Air Force is just feeding the C-130s. So you got to pick between, you know, slicks or just like normal C-130s or AFSOC. And then you got to pick on location. And it's, again, you're racked and stacked basically on how well you did in training. And you go in, it's kind of a big deal. You go in and the commander just has a sheet of paper with all of the options listed on it. And he calls you in the office in order that you graduated. And you don't really know where you rank in the class until that day. So, you know, your name gets called first and you're like, okay, you get the pick of whatever you want. If your name gets called last, you walk in there and you know, you have to pick what everybody else didn't want. So I think I was like, you know, third or fourth in my class somewhere. And I went in there and there was a C-130H to Little Rock. And I wanted to go to Little Rock, you know, join the Air Force to see the world. And I wanted to move back home. But, you know, I wanted to go back to Little Rock. I wanted J models, but there was a H. So I was like, yeah, I'll fly H's at Little Rock. And, you know, it is what it is. Anyway, about an hour after that meeting, you know, I'd gone home, told the family, you know, that we're moving back to Little Rock, flying the H model. And we were all excited. And I get a phone call from my commander and he's like, hey, Lieutenant Lake, we messed up. That wasn't an H model to Little Rock. And I was like, oh man, what am I going to get now? He's like, that was actually a J model at Little Rock. So you get to fly J's. I was like, yes.
Even better.
Yeah.
What's the difference?
Yeah, so I moved from Corpus to Little Rock, and you start the formal training unit, which takes, I think back then is like 8 months or so. You do a lot of simulator. I would say it's similar to a type rating in the civilian world, but no type rating that I know of takes 8 months. So yeah,
21 days.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So you start out, you do a couple months of sims, or a couple months of ground and then sims. And then you do about a month at the flying squadron where you do your tactical qual. And that takes about 4 weeks where you're actually flying the airplane. So kind of part of your type rating you do in the actual jet versus the rest you do in the sim. And then you move over to your squadron and start your in-doc process. So it winds up taking about a year and a half to get spun up where you're kind of mission ready in the C-130.
And when does your kind of...
I wanted to fly the J. It was new back then. So the J model is like all glass display, heads-up display, bigger engines. And it was kind of the new, it was pretty new when I started to fly it. I was one of the, I wouldn't say one of the first co-pilots, but I was early on in that pipeline. So it's been really fun to fly.
I bet. I mean, yeah, anytime you get some glass cockpit in there away from the old steam gauges, you know, it's a pretty good thing.
Yeah, it's been great. Yeah, it's great.
All right, let's take a break from today's episode to hear from our sponsor, RAA. As a pilot, you rely on precision planning, trusted resources, and experience each day. And that's just what RAA brings to financial planning. You see, they're uniquely positioned to serve the airline community because RAA was created by pilots to serve pilots, which is why they've earned the trust of and served thousands in aviation industry for more than 3 decades. But more importantly, RAA's airline specialized advisors understand the unique set of needs, challenges, and goals associated with your career, including those factors that can affect your financial life and security. And that's why it's important to work with the right financial partner. Because whether you're just entering the airline industry or nearing your final flight, the team at RAA is here to support your journey from takeoff to touchdown. Learn more about the benefit of working with an RAA airline specialized advisor today at raa.com/pilot to pilot. That's raa.com/pilot to pilot. Now back to today's episode.
So for that whole long process, the year and a half that it takes for you to kind of get checked out that you're talking about, does your commitment to the Air Force start as soon as you start flying the line, essentially, or is it right when you start your training, or when does that kind of start with that?
Yeah, good question. So that your commitment, first of all, when I went through, it was a 10-year commitment, and your 10-year starts from the time that you're winged or the time that you're rated. So when you graduate pilot training, your 2-year commitment or 10-year commitment starts. By then, I only already had about 2 years in time in service. So essentially, I wound up having like a 12-year commitment in total, because your 10-year starts from the time that you put your wings on. So it starts before you are rated in the C-130. So you don't have to wait that long, but you do, none of your pilot training commitment counts towards your pilot training commitment.
Looking back at your kind of Air Force career that you have, do you have any regrets? Do you like think now, like, wow, the F-22 is kind of cool, I could have done that? Or you're pretty happy with the C-130?
Yeah, I don't think I was smart enough to fly the F-22.
I'm talking to some F-22 people. They don't seem to know. I'm just kidding.
No, I don't have any regrets. I never really wanted to fly fighters. So my dad was Army, and he was actually stationed in Korea for a little bit. And he got to know some F-16 pilots. And so talking with him when I was a teenager about the F-16 lifestyle that he saw, because he had some friends doing that, it's like, I don't know that that's really the, flying a fighter, I'm sure would be a blast. I'm sure that would be awesome. But, their lifestyle is, they pre-brief a lot. A lot of it's classified because of all the threat systems that you have to study. So you're spending a lot of time in the vault, and then you go and you do your 1-hour sortie, and then you land and you debrief for another, 4 or 5 hours. And, it's kind of taxing, I think, after a while. Whereas, mobility pilot, the C-130, I feel like it's the best of both worlds, because we get to fly VFR low level. So we get to do some fun stuff. So we get to, bomb around a low level for, 2 or 3 hours, come back, we debrief for a little bit, and then go back out and do it, in actual, we've done that in combat versus, the really cool dogfighting stuff you get to do in a fighter. If you look back on the conflicts that we've had, very little dogfighting's happening. I mean, you get to drop bombs and stuff, but the really cool stuff you saw in Top Gun, it's not like we're getting in a lot of air-to-air engagements with terrorist organizations. But with the C-130 going out and doing a formation low level to an airdrop, which is like our version of dogfighting, like that's the hardest thing we can do. We actually get to do that in combat. So getting to actually do the full gambit of your mission, all the time is a lot of fun. And then it's a good variety in the C-130. So we do low level stuff, but we also do kind of more STRATCOM. We're really slow, but I've flown it across the Pacific, across the Atlantic. So you get to do that kind of long haul flying too. So I think it's a great mix.
Do you think flying the C-130 set you up for 121 life a little better than what, say, a F-22 pilot, F-35, or a F-16, F-18 pilot?
Yeah. I don't know. I've never been a fighter guy, but, you are really used to that crew environment. That CRM is not anything new at all. So sitting in the cockpit of a 737 is very similar to sitting in the cockpit of the C-130. A lot of the callouts are the same, the way we, manage our crew, the way we think about flying the plane. I fly the 73 now, and, I've kind of noticed the 7.3 is just like a faster version of the C-130. It's almost the same size. It carries about the same fuel. It's just twice as fast as a C-130.
I can't do the tactical mission that the C-130 can do, though.
Yeah, we can't do a low level. So, you know, I have noticed the C-130, like, it flies more like a real airplane versus the 7.3 is like a little more sluggish. But you can, but they're both about the same heaviness on the controls. But yeah, it's like, you know, they're very, very similar.
Yeah. And for the timely joke of the month, the C-130 keeps its exit doors on, I'm guessing.
Yeah, but we, you know, we open our doors on purpose in the 7.3 in flight. So, you know, when we do airdrop, we actually open our doors on purpose. But, you know, if Boeing wants to get into the tactical airdrop mission and you know, make some doors that are supposed to open in flight, I guess that might help them get a military contract or something.
They can call you. You can help, right?
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny. Well, it's not funny. It stinks, but you got to laugh at it, right? There's nothing else you can really do. No one died.
Yeah, nobody died. Laugh. But man, just thinking about that passenger that's in that exit row with that door off, you know, that would be a significant emotional event. I'll put it that way.
Yeah. And that poor Max series of airplanes and just does not have a good record. Whatever it is, it's just not good.
Anyways,
from that, we won't focus on that. So you're coming up C-130. What would you say is your favorite thing the C-130 can do and your least favorite? Now, I know you're going to say slow, so you can't say slow for the least favorite, but what's your favorite thing the C-130 does and your least favorite?
Favorite thing is formation low level flying. It's just a lot of fun. You know, we'll find a good canyon to fly up. These low level routes, you'll see there's three types of low level routes. There's slow routes, instrument routes, and visual routes. Instrument routes and visual routes, you have a waiver. You can break the 250 knot speed limit below 10,000, which we can't do anyway, really. We can't fly that fast, so we just fly slow routes. But all of these are surveyed usually from the surface up to about 5,000 feet. So I don't know who surveys these, but we can fly these routes well below 500 feet. So, you know, if you have terrain following radar in some C-130s, you're going to be going really low. But we typically are around 300 to 500 feet at about 200 knots. And you do that in a basic two-ship formation is what we normally fly in. But, you know, I've flown in as many as like a 20-ship formation. Typically, if you're flying that larger formation, you're not doing low level. You're doing like an instrument formation. But anyway, doing visual low level with a 2 or 4 ship and then throwing stuff out of the back onto the drop zone, it's just, man, it's so much fun. Because there's kind of that... there's that competition aspect to it. You get to actually drop something out of the plane and see how close you can get to the target. You get to see, you know, your time control over the target. You're constantly kind of trying to improve. So it's like a game, you know, it's great. It's so much fun. So I love that part of it. The thing that I don't like about the C-130 is, probably as far as the mission is the strat airlift. So when we have to fly, you know, oceanic in the C-130, that's why I chose the airline I chose, which doesn't do any long haul stuff. Because I really don't like long haul. I don't want to do it. I've done it enough. I'm like, yeah, I'm over that. So, I don't like sitting in the seat for that long.
Well, I was going to leave you on the next question. You're currently, let's go back to before you choose your 121 carrier, but you're on your way out of active duty and you're thinking to yourself, all right, I can kind of re-enlist or whatever it's called. I can keep going. I can do this full time, or I can get a sweet gig at an airline. What, aside from not flying oceanic routes, what was kind of like your main factor in choosing that? Or was it just that I don't want to fly across the Pacific or the Atlantic? Let me go there.
Well, I got out in 2019 and I applied to a couple different airlines. I didn't get a call, but I did get hired as or designated as a DPE. And I happened to have a couple of airplanes at the time. So I actually got out and started a flight school. So I ran a flight school full time for about 4 years, and we focused on multi-engine ratings and ATP ratings. And I did that all up until last year, full time. And then finally last year, you know, there's a lot of things that happened that led me to kind of look at the airlines again. And kind of on a whim, I was like, okay, the flight school's successful. I could do this full time. You know, it's a lot of work, but I enjoy it. And, you know, running the flight school, doing the DPE gig, and then being in the reserves, I was probably making, you know, as much as I would be at an airline. But the airline opportunity, I was like, well, let's give it another shot. And because the carrier that I applied to in 19 never even called me back. So I was like, well, let me apply again. I sent in an application, and then 2 days later, you know, got an invite and did the interview process, got a CGO. So then I was like, okay, now I have an actual choice. I can choose to go to the airlines, or I can, you know, keep doing the civilian aviation thing. And in the end, it's like just the benefits that you get, the quality of life that you get as an airline pilot, kind of looking at the longevity of like, well, I don't need this job right now as an airline pilot. It's kind of boring, honestly, but I could see, you know, when I'm older, and, you know, don't want to be as active, it's a lot more manageable then. But then I wound up when I actually started doing it, I was like, no, I actually enjoy this. This is a fun job. And then having the reserves to fall back on and do the fun flying still. And then I still own a couple aircraft. So, I kind of got to keep my foot in a little bit of everything for the time being. It's a little busy, but I wound up really enjoying the airlines a lot. So.
Yeah. I mean, I can't imagine owning a flight school. That just seems like a lot to go with it. A lot of drama with students, with aircraft, with maintenance. Like, I mean, when I look back on my own training and just thinking about all like what I thought was drama around there, you multiply that by however many students you have. Like, I just can't imagine like being in charge of that and kind of maintaining relationships and making sure everyone is happy and laying your foot down when you have to be like, no, you're not doing it right. Or this is your blah, 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 you know? So that would be very stressful. I could see why the airline route could kind of seem very advantageous. And then you throw in the fact that some airlines, you can work as little as you want, as much as you want. You can make as much as you want, make as little as you want, free up time for yourself to do what you want. So there's opportunities for you to still do a flight school or be involved in GA like you are right now. So being an airline pilot gives you a lot of flexibility. Maybe not right away, you know, maybe you got to get some seniority, but it's a great opportunity.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You got to, you know, the airline I'm at now is, super flexible. That's one of the reasons why I went there. So even as a really junior pilot, I can kind of make the schedule flex to my needs, you know, a lot. So it's way more flexible than even owning my own business. Cause yeah, you own your own business, you sort of are in control of your schedule, but you know, you have customers that you have to work around, and really you have to run the business. So you don't really make your own schedule. You just, you know, own your own schedule, I guess. So
you essentially work all the time.
Yeah.
You find yourself having like an hour of free time, and instead of not doing anything, you're like, oh, I guess I could answer some emails. Or it's like last night I was sending emails at like 10 o'clock. My wife's like, what are you doing? I was like, I don't have time today to get the emails out. I got to send them.
Yeah. Yeah. I still have to deal. I mean, I still have my own business per se, because the DPE, job is kind of like a business. You know, there's a lot of coordination you got to do with check rides and, you know, everybody's schedule and weather and reschedules. So there's still work to be done. And that's what's nice about the airline is like I go and work an 8 hour day. I've got, you know, almost guaranteed, you know, 13 or 14 hours on the ground where I've got some hotel time. And, you know, I can work those schedule pieces while I'm on a 3 day trip pretty easily. So it pairs just really well. I love it. It's a great job.
And then going back to the flight school, how do you start a flight school? Is it as easy as, you know, when people want to become pilots or don't even think about becoming a pilot, but they are going through the process of figuring out how to become a pilot, they don't realize how easy it is to just go to a flight school and go fly. Is it the same thing with starting a flight school? Is it really as much as just like having a plane, having a building, and going to fly? Obviously, there's a ton of insurance that you have to get with that, but is it really just like that simple?
Yeah, I started with one airplane, and it was just me and one airplane. and I just had a twin, so I only did multi-engine ratings, which is nice because I could bring people in for like a 4 or 5 day course. You know, we do all the flying and then I move to the next client. So it worked out really well. So yeah, you just buy the airplane, you know, you're certified as an instructor. You get commercial insurance for your plane. Depending on where you're at, I'm in city limits, so I needed a business license as well. I started an LLC and, you know, ran everything through the LLC. So, you can make it as formal of affair as you want, or you could do, you know, cash only, you know, don't set up, you know, any credit card payment systems or anything like that. You could run it, you know, really small, or you can scale it to however big you want, or, you know, something like ATP. So yeah, I started with one airplane. At our largest, we were about five. We had five twins and a single and five instructors, and a couple staff members. So we got to be, you know, it was a big operation. I felt like it was a big operation.
I mean, it sounds like a big operation to me. Is that flight school still running now, or did it kind of cease when you kind of made the decision to go 121?
Well, all the, you know, I'm in my flight school's office now. It's called VSL Aviation. So anyway, the school is still here. Like, we still have the LLC, and I still even do some training. But right now it's kind of by invite only, and it's really just me. And I've got one contract guy who's also a NetJets guy, by chance. So that's when funny. He's off, he's on like the Crew Choice 52. So when he has time off, he can he's do got some, a lot of time off. Yeah, he can do some training for me.
Yeah,
yeah, the business is still here, and I want to grow it in a different way. You know, later on, kind of focusing more on doing content stuff, but do some training after this first. You know, once I get off probation with Southwest, and be able to, you know, free up my schedule a little bit more.
Yeah. And then talking about DPE, we mentioned a little bit earlier about how DPE shortage, everything's going on. But one specific question I want to ask is, when we talked about, there's a ton of people training right now. Have you noticed a difference in the people that are training now? Maybe quality of pilot per se, the difference in the quality that we're seeing now coming out versus what we saw 10, 15 years ago, or do you think it's all about the same and nothing's really changed?
Well, yeah, I've only been an examiner for 5 years now. So I've seen the past 5 years worth. I can't say, hey, 10 years ago, the applicants were a lot better. But what I have seen is an increase in the number of these programs that offer, you know, very, very accelerated programs where you're going from like zero to an MEI in, you know, less than a year in some cases is what they're advertising, which is just, I don't see how they're doing that. I have run into some, you know, CFI applicants, especially that are on these really accelerated paths, and they come to do their CFI with me and they only have, you know, let's say, you know, 230 hours. They do about as well as a 230 hour pilot would do. You know, it's like, I think to be to be a good instructor, you probably need, you know, a little more experience than that. Some of those applicants do just fine, and but some of them are really struggling. So I've noticed that on, especially those accelerated programs, I'm maybe more likely to run into applicants that are a little less prepared than somebody that's maybe done a more traditional like Part 61 over a year and a half to get maybe there's a private instrument. It is a little bit slower, but you get to see kind of a broader aspect of aviation. I think you're a little more well-rounded, a little more experienced, a little more confident. But yeah, when you're forced through this really accelerated program, you can show up to the check ride and maybe not be quite as confident as somebody else that took a little more time.
What's the fastest way to fail your check ride? What's the fastest way to fail your check ride? The one like an ick or just something that's like immediate, like, no, I'm sorry. We just, it's done. Go back. We're done.
Yeah. So I briefed this in the check ride. The fastest way probably is to, if you don't do a good cockpit check and brake check. So you get in the airplane and you don't do a brake check, the FAA says, you know, one of the skills that you have to demonstrate proficiency on is do a brake check. And so if you don't do a brake check, that could lead to an immediate failure. That's kind of a boneheaded way to fail your check ride. So always check your brakes. Another one is if you land short on the short field, the ACS doesn't allow you to land short at all. You can land slightly long, you just can't land short. So if you land short on your short field, that's a quick way to do it. As far as the quickest way, you know, you can fail your check ride in the oral. So if on the ground you're not prepared, you don't know your systems, then that's a quick way to fail your check ride. So fortunately, that's pretty easy. You know, there's a lot of study material out there to help prepare you for your check ride. That's pretty easy to avoid. But that would be a quick way, is to, you know, not be prepared there.
And then, can you tell usually from the first couple of minutes how a check ride's going to go? Like when you sit down and you meet them, the interaction, is it pretty spot on with how the check ride ends up turning out, or if it's a harder one or an easier one?
Yeah, when you sit down and somebody's not prepared, they're not very confident, maybe they're missing an endorsement. So now you have to track down their instructor, try to get this missing endorsement or fix something that's in their logbook. And it just amps up the stress because they're feeling like, oh man, I've already screwed up and we haven't even started. I'm not really worried about it. So on my end, it's just another day at the office. You know, this happens all the time. But on their end, they're like sitting there getting more and more stressed. And then when it comes time to starting to ask questions, you know, for the oral, when we get started, you know, they're already flustered. They're already, you know, feel like they're under the gun, and it just goes downhill from there. So if you show up and do the easy stuff, like just make sure you're really well prepared and you're legal to take this check ride. So you've got, you know, everything in your logbook is all clearly spelled out that, hey, I've met all the flying requirements. I've got all my endorsements ready. I've got my nav log here printed off. I've got, you know, a nice binder that maybe has all my personal minimums and my all the documents that are required for the check ride, and just show up really well prepared. Then you kind of start off on the right foot, and then the check ride, you know, the application process goes smoothly. And generally speaking, I don't make this assumption, but you know, the perception is if you're well prepared for the check ride, you're probably well prepared for you know, the questions, the oral, the flight, all that stuff. And if you come up and you're not really, you know, well prepared for the check ride, then there's probably, you know, subconscious me thinking, well, are you really prepared to be a pilot? You know, if you're not even ready to take this check ride, are you ready to go out there and command a pilot? So, I think that's really important, is to show up well prepared.
Yeah. And you as an examiner, how would you say that you've changed since day one, 5 years ago till now?
My first few check rides were pretty long. I didn't have a very good scenario to cover all the bases. And I think my first private pilot check ride, the oral, was probably like 4 or 5 hours long.
The guy's like, I thought it was supposed to be short.
Yeah, I'm going through this ACS, and I wasn't really well practiced at that. So now I feel like, you know, my scenarios and the way I ask questions, I feel like have evolved and gotten better to where I can get a check ride done, still evaluate the ACS thoroughly, but I can get the check ride done a lot faster than what I was in the past. Now, maybe those were, you know, and that's probably better for the applicant too, because, you know, you can imagine after a 4 hour oral, by the time you're ready to go fly, you're like, yeah, this is going to be hard. So I think my applicants, do a little bit better there. I've got a lot of, you know, videos and podcasts of my own that help people prepare for the check ride. So I've noticed that when people listen to those, they do a better job too, because they know, okay, this is what I have to have ready for this check ride to be successful. The check rides have gotten a little bit shorter for sure.
You know, I think if I was to look down at my sheet or my CFI, it's like, hey, you're going to do this pot or this check ride with Seth. It's like, all right, let me Google Seth real quick. It's like, oh, he's got all these podcasts. Maybe I should watch and listen to some of those because they give me some tips on how to pat. That would help me with him as my DPE, especially. So if anyone is going to take a check audit, you recommend that you check out all stuff. So how would you go about finding your stuff and doing it and listening and watching?
Oh, sure. Appreciate it. Just vsl.aero is the website, and it has links to, you know, if you want to book a check ride with me, if you want to listen to some of the content or find us on YouTube. I do videos on YouTube, and I've got Instagram, Facebook, all the regular, but it's mainly under VSL Aviation. So that's how you can find me.
Well, check it out, especially with a check ride with them, so you don't have to fail it.
Yeah.
All right. I got a couple of rapid fire questions for you. All right. You ready for these rapid fire questions? They're just very quick questions. Give me very quick answers. Don't think about them too much. Just rattle them off.
Ready.
All right. What's your favorite airplane you've ever flown?
The Beechcraft Travel Air.
All right. What's the ugliest airplane you've ever seen?
I meant to look this up because I know you asked this question. It's a four-engine prop job. They used to fly cars around Europe. There's one north of Denton parked on the ramp there.
Is it shorter or is it long?
No, it's longer. I'll have to look it up. Yeah, I don't know. Somebody in the North Texas area knows exactly what I'm talking about, but super ugly.
Who in the industry would you like to meet most?
I would. Does they have to be alive?
No, they can be dead or alive. Either way.
I would have loved to sat down with Bob Hoover. I would really like to have met him.
How'd you not spill that sweet tea, Bob? I don't understand. what is something you wish you knew before you became a pilot?
You know, I kind of wish I would have gone in the Air Force as a loadmaster first, right out of high school. Kind of wish I would have done that. I think being a loadmaster and enlisted, that would have, I think there's some benefits there. And that's what I've been encouraging a lot of people to do that are interested in being a pilot. It's like go and enlist in the Air Force. And it's actually pretty straightforward how to transition from enlisted to officer to become a pilot. So if you want to be an Air Force pilot, I think a great way to do that is to enlist as a, you know, enlisted air crew member first. I kind of wish I would have done that. That or gone in as maintenance, because I'm working on my AMP right now and trying to get all the hours for my AMP while you're also, you know, a pilot is really difficult.
Doing content. Yeah, I get it, man. What's the hardest flight you've ever flown?
The hardest flight?
Yeah.
My first combat flight in the C-130, it was in Afghanistan, and we were working tactics. So a tactics job is like I'm working a desk job for the first 2 weeks I'm in Afghanistan. And this was during the surge. It was actually pretty active then. And somebody called in sick and they're like, hey, Lieutenant, like, you know, you're going to be on tomorrow's night flight to this drop zone. And it was a kind of a medium threat drop zone. We couldn't do a certain running angle, so we couldn't drop all of our cargo on one drop. We had to make three passes to get all the cargo off. We could only drop there at night because we had been getting shot at during the day. So it was going to be an NVG airdrop, and we're making three passes. So it was pretty dynamic. They were going to soften the DZ with a B1 before we came in. So we had to orbit a B1, like blew up some stuff around the DZ. And then we come in for three passes. And on the first pass, like I'm suffering from, you know, we call it helmet fire, but it's like you're talking to all these different radios. It's just, it was chaos, you know, and I was barely hanging on. And I forgot to go, I forgot to move a switch. And we went for our first pass and nothing came out. You know, we were supposed to drop and the green light never came on. Nothing came out. And I looked down. I was like, I didn't move the switch. So we had to make four passes to a medium threat DZ at night on MBGs and with people trying to shoot at us. So that was a really eye-opening flight. I learned a lot then. And no, that was tough.
Welcome to Afghanistan, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, geez, that's crazy. So aside from least favorite flight, what's your favorite flight you've ever flown?
Probably one of our, we have a Beechcraft Travel Air that we do family vacations in. So probably just any of those are just so much fun to load the family up in the plane and either go down to the Keys or, you know, we've gone to Disney, to the Carolinas, you know, just that's just so much fun loading up the family and going for a family flight to somewhere fun, you know, have a nice vacation and fly back. Those are just really memorable experiences, a lot of fun.
Does the family like flying as much as you do? Is it as much fun to them as it is to you?
Yeah, I think so. I think they all really enjoy it. No nervous flyers, which is good. So yeah, I think they enjoy it.
What's your favorite airport you've ever landed at?
Sedona.
What's your least favorite airport to land at? Midway in the
sun. Yeah, Midway, maybe.
IFR or VFR, what would you rather fly?
VFR.
What's your hardest check ride you yourself have ever had?
Ooh, my 121 check ride.
Oh, really? Airlines.
It should have been easy. It was just one of those. I've given thousands of check rides, and that check ride, I like fell into all of these traps I think that I'd seen other people fall into, and I just had a really bad day, and luckily I passed. I had a really nice examiner, but man, that was a rough day.
That's got to be the worst when you know the trap question and you just keep going farther into the trap. You're like, no, what am I doing?
Oh yeah. Yeah, it was terrible.
Yeah, well, good thing is you passed and now you can laugh about it, right?
Hey, yeah I passed. Yeah.
Would you rather fly over mountains, beaches, or the city?
Mountains.
141 training or 61 training?
61.
Yeah, I like it. CRJ or ERJ, what would you rather commute on?
I think the ERJ. I don't commute on those a lot, but I think the ERJ is the one I like.
The 175, that's a good one. What's the biggest win of your career?
The biggest win?
Yeah.
Probably getting hired at the airline that I wanted. You know, that was a big win.
What's the biggest regret of your career?
I don't know. Nothing really stands out. There wasn't anything that was like, man, I really wish I hadn't have done that, because maybe at the time I was like, yeah, this isn't the greatest, but that led to where I'm at now. So looking back on it, I don't really see it as a regret. So.
Yeah, no regrets. Right? Yeah, no regrets. last one here is you got a quick little flight. Actually, I got two more. Well, would you rather fly the longest trip possible in a 737, which I'm guessing you're going to say no because you don't want to fly Oceanic or anything like that? Or would you rather fly as many short trips and as many legs as possible in a 737?
Yeah, give me the legs. I'll take a Texas two-step with like five legs any day over a like a five-hour ETOPS. Yeah.
No, yeah. Thanks. What's your go-to airport food for you?
I don't know. I'm not a big. I pack all my food. So.
Oh, nice.
Try to do that. Probably a Starbucks coffee is definitely go to. I'll get a coffee from Starbucks because it's not the greatest coffee, but it's dependable, and there's one at like almost every airport.
Yep.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, Seth, thank you so much for coming on the podcast, man. I really appreciate it. Thank you for everything you do for DPE, for general aviation, content wise. We appreciate it. Keep it up, and maybe we'll see you in an airport someday.
Yeah, it's good to see you. Thanks for having me, and take care.
Yep. Absolutely. Right, have a good one, all right?
All right, you too. All right, cool.
That's a wrap on today's episode. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. I've said this a couple times, but you know, your dad, your mom, you know, your brother, sister, their phone's just laying around. Pull up Spotify. Go to the Pilot Podcast. Maybe they'll become a pilot. You never know. Subscribe, follow, like, listen, share, whatever you need to do to get this podcast out there for more aviators. We could use them all. But Aviation, I hope you're having a great day. And as always, happy flying. Pilot the Pilot LLC is compensated to make recommendations to his or her followers regarding the services of RAA or Allworth Airline Advisors, companies of Allworth Financial, LP, or Allworth. Promoter is not an employee or investment advisor representative of Allworth. Promoter is a current client of Allworth. Allworth-based promoter fee of $4,000 a month for sponsorship of the Pilot the Pilot podcast. Due to the compensation arrangement between Allworth and promoter, promoter has an incentive to recommend Allworth, resulting in material conflict of interest. Promoter's role on behalf of Allworth is limited strictly to making recommendations regarding the services of Allworth, introducing or referring prospective clients to Allworth. Promoter has no responsibility with respect to Allworth's investment advisor or other advisory services.